The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We recall some American radicalism from 45 years ago this hour. And look at a presidential campaign's vulnerability to all kinds of wild cards in the headlines and elsewhere. We start with politics this hour in the simmering summer of 16. I guarantee you will be forgiven if somehow you missed the name of Evan McMullen throwing his name into the presidential race last week, though.
The fact that Donald Trump is down by 10% at this stage and still saying the ridiculous things he does that are so unpresidential at the very least, just shows that this is not a guy who has any chance of beating Hillary. And I think that's something that a lot of people are starting to understand very clearly now. We are overwhelmed by the number of staffers here in Washington and members of Congress who have also reached out.
That's Evan McMullen speaking on MSNBC. Now, if your judgment of a candidate relates to whether they have a chance to beat Hillary Clinton, then McMullen is an odd choice for GOP insiders. He's only on the ballot in Colorado and Minnesota, and Minnesota has some very close congressional races. But in this curious moment of dormancy between the conventions and the launch of the final weeks after Labor Day, it's the aggregate count of alternative candidates, support for people like the Jill Stein Greens and the Gary Johnson Libertarians that just might be disruptive in all kinds of ways. Here to explain why is Sam Wong, founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. He's right here in the studio. He's a neuroscientist at Princeton University.
The big thing that's happening this year in regard to third and fourth and fifth party candidates is that Donald Trump is losing some significant fraction of Republican voters. I estimate that in red states, states that Romney won in 2012, Trump seems to be running as much as about 5 to 15 points below where Mitt Romney ran 4 years ago. And so there are a lot of votes up for grabs, and this puts down ticket races at risk. So these fourth and fifth party candidates perceive an opportunity.
So the opportunity is, this is a proposition that maybe not Gary Johnson's, but certainly Evan McMullen is making to voters. It says, all right, you feel like you don't have a reason to go to the polls. Your Senate candidate, your congressional candidate isn't doing it for you. Look, if you aren't voting for Trump, but still want to feel like you're a part of the GOP, come on down, vote for Evan McMullen, and oh, by the way, be sure to vote for the other Republicans on the ticket, and they can kind of have their cake and eat it too. They don't stay home, and their Republican support goes for the support of Congress.
That's right. So McMullen is a GOP House staffer. He's, up until recently, policy director of the Republican Conference. He's an insider. This is not somebody with the resume of somebody who wanted to be president since he was a boy. He is very much an insider, and right now I would say that the House could go either way in November. The Democrats have some fighting chance of getting it, and these edge cases are close races are ones where somebody like McMullen can help save the down ticket.
And for Hillary, the problem is exactly the opposite. It's basically if you've got to come out and vote because if Donald Trump gets elected, the end of the world is upon us. So therefore, please come and vote for Hillary Clinton. And oh, by the way, vote for the rest of the Democrats.
Well, there are people who like Hillary Clinton, but it is also true that the end of the world would be considered a bad thing. But in either case, I think that the idea would be to that in order to get any work done next year, Hillary Clinton would need a majority, ideally in both the Senate and the House. And so right now, let's imagine hypothetically that the presidency is heading towards being settled. The question is, who's going to be in control of Congress? And that is a question that is in the balance right now.
And so let's talk about someone besides Evan McMullen. Does the Libertarian Party have a chance to do what Nader did in 2000 in a much more disruptive way?
The Libertarian Party has never gotten more than 1% of the popular vote in the U.S. in any presidential election. And so I think it would be a hard lift for them to make a big difference. The other thing about the Libertarian Party is that they don't give out the GOP message. And so it could be a breakout moment for them, but they're unlikely to swing any major election in the U.S.
So angry Republicans aren't going to vote for Libertarians. They might, but they aren't going to feel like Republicans doing it.
I think that they might. One hears talk in interviews and just talking to neighbors and so on. I've heard people say, Republican friends say that they just can't vote for Donald Trump, but they certainly are not voting for Hillary Clinton. And a few of them are talking about staying home. And if they stay home, then that's no good for the Republicans.
Gary Johnson makes the argument that if the pollsters put in their top line of their polls, and apparently you have to reach 15% to get into the debates, that if the top line of the polls was, who do you want, Gary Johnson, Hillary Clinton, or Donald Trump, or some version of that without Gary Johnson being first, that they would be at 12% today, and that the debate question then would be, yes, they'd be on the podium with the other two candidates, Gary Johnson would, and that would settle the matter, and then we would be in a more of a nadir zone. What do you say about that?
I think for purposes of getting invited to the debate, one could imagine Johnson hitting 15%. He has not yet. Generally speaking, in terms of the real-life election, third-party candidates fade in the finish in the U.S. It is highly unusual for anything else to happen. An exception was Ross Perot, but that's because Ross Perot was perceived as being within a realistic striking distance of winning. And so generally speaking, third-party candidates fade. The other thing is that the reason that Nader was able to be any kind of spoiler was that the Gore-Bush race was within one percentage point of the popular vote. Mm-hmm. And that's not where things are today. Hillary Clinton is up on Donald Trump by something like 8 or 9 points nationally. And that's just not a range where a third-party candidate is likely to make a difference.
Thinking about Ross Perot, which is an interesting model, I mean, if we think of Donald Trump as Ross Perot, as an outlier who's challenging the system and who is basically a radical vote who, you know what, I'm throwing my dice in the air and, yeah, things are going to be different, but darn it, I can't stand the way it is now. Does he tail off as we get towards November? Or does he increase in support, barring some radical new kind of way of campaigning, which seems much more like Ross Perot now than it does
anything else? That's an interesting point. So far in surveys, Trump has not gotten below 40%. It seems like about 20% of Republicans, one-fifth of Republicans, would like to see someone else, won't vote for him. But he seems to have hit a floor there at 40%. Now, on the other hand, he seems to be doing his best to try to get below that floor. And so if he goes below that floor, I can imagine it. But right now, I think that what we're seeing is a sign of a symptom of the strong polarization in the United States, where people will vote for their party's candidate, even when their party's candidate seems to be saying pretty incendiary things.
Sam Wong is a data analyst and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. He's also a neuroscientist at Princeton University. Great to have you in here.
Thank you.
Let's pause for a moment and recall that in the middle of a hot summer, 45 years ago, President Richard Nixon announced that the United States would be breaking a promise that would shock the global economy to its core.
I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold or other reserve assets, except in amounts and conditions determined to be in the interest of monetary stability and in the best interest of the United States. In full cooperation with the International Monetary Fund and those who trade with us, we will press for the necessary reforms to set up an urgently needed new international monetary system.
What? The U.S. dollar would no longer be convertible? The promise that the U.S. dollar was convertible into gold at a fixed $35 an ounce rate, and that's a joke, that's another story, was what had underlaid the stability of the post-war global economy. But now, it had succeeded too well. The broken nations of the U.K., France, Germany, and especially Japan had bounced back by 1971. This Nixon shock, as it was called, had a 90-day freeze on wages and prices to control inflation. It was also the end of giving all those nations the advantages that they'd enjoyed since the 1940s. This Nixon move established the system of oversight and convertibility we know now, and which is now, in a certain sense, crumbling. Douglas Irwin is professor of economics at Dartmouth College. He says this came directly out of Nixon's famous penchant for secrecy and springing surprises on the American electorate and the world.
Well, it was hatched in secret. President Nixon, who was very worried about leaks to the press and to other countries, told his advisors on Thursday afternoon, prepare to go in secret to Camp David on Friday. And that weekend, we're going to hatch our plan and spring it on the world economy on Sunday night in a nationally televised address.
And that yanked the carpet out from underneath the whole Bretton Woods agreement, which set up the post-war economic order.
It really was sort of the end of the Bretton Woods system, which was set up in New Hampshire in 1944, right after World War II. And what that mandated was fixed exchange rates between countries. So other countries would fix the value of their currency in terms of the dollar, and supposedly the dollar was backed by gold, so foreign central banks could exchange their dollar reserves for U.S. gold in Fort Knox.
And when did that start giving advantages to other nations like the U.K. and Germany that were politically sensitive, or West Germany at that time, were politically sensitive to Richard Nixon, that he thought of doing this shock in secret at Camp David?
Early on in the post-war period, the U.S. had very large trade surpluses, and one could argue that the dollar was undervalued. But increasingly, the U.S. had a rising rate of inflation, and the dollar became overvalued relative to other currencies. And we started running a trade deficit. 1971, we had the first trade deficit since the 1930s. And this is viewed as a big problem. The dollar was misaligned relative to those other currencies. Other countries didn't want to change their exchange rates. So what the Nixon administration did was say, OK, you can't exchange your dollars for gold anymore. And we want you to revalue, that is, increase the price of your currencies relative to the dollar.
And so since that time, all the currencies of Europe and the United States and Japan have floated.
That's right. So through the 50s and 60s, most exchange rates were fixed. They only changed on occasion if there was a big problem. They tried to patch together these fixed exchange rates for another year or so, but then countries gave up. And basically, we have, as you mentioned today, floating exchange rates. The value changes of the dollar every day on foreign exchange markets. Some countries continue to fix to some extent, or at least intervene a lot, but we've certainly departed from what we had after World War II with fixed exchange rates.
But, you know, in all of our condemnation of Richard Nixon and his secrecy and his illegality and all the things he did behind closed doors, this was a good one in hindsight, yes?
Moving to floating exchange rates relieved a lot of the problems we had at the time. So, yes, that was a good thing. Now, the wage and price controls, which were announced at the same time, that didn't work out so well.
The exchange rate that Nixon established, this whole system that Nixon established on some level with many, many changes since 1971, is part of what's changing today with the China's entrance into the world economy and other things going on with the euro. Is that correct, or is it really, again, we're way, way beyond 1971?
No, you're correct. It's really, whenever governments fix exchange rates, there's going to be some controversy about whether they've hit the right target. For the past 10, 15 years or so, a lot of people have alleged that China has deliberately undervalued its currency to give its exporters a competitive advantage. And of course, we've seen with the euro fixing exchange rates across the different European countries, that's led to big problems too with Greece and Spain and Italy. And so whenever governments fix exchange rates, there's bound to be political controversy and there's bound to be economic problems that follow.
Douglas Irwin is professor of economics at Dartmouth College. Thank you so much, Douglas.
You're welcome.
A police shooting in Milwaukee and violence in the streets marks the continuation of something simmering in this summer of 16. Evaluating these events has become part of the American conversation this year. One person was shot, a police officer was injured in the second night of violence that produced damage and protests in Milwaukee. A police shooting of a black man, allegedly by an as yet unidentified black officer, who investigators say the suspect was in possession of a firearm that triggered the violence. It's been an astonishingly violent year for Chicago, where 2,579 people have been shot since January 1. The numbers rise and fall. The national media focuses on Chicago streets one day, Milwaukee streets the next. We want to start this conversation with someone who does not have the luxury of looking away from the street-level view of urban America. Aisha Jaco is the co-founder and director of the youth empowerment organization Mural, M-U-R-A-L. She says her work goes on, even though there is no sound from the presidential campaign that the lives she is trying to save on both sides matter.
We provide opportunities for young people to get out of their communities, to see the world via our study abroad programs. We funded and incubated structural violence campaigns led by young people because they wanted to give voice to particularly a young lady, Hydea Pendleton, who made the national news, who was murdered here in Chicago. They wanted to give more voice to the issue here in Chicago. So we were able to fund that campaign and help give it visibility. We also do a lot of work around education here in Chicago, because when we look at violence in Chicago, it's rooted in a lot of disparity that young people face. It's rooted in poverty. It's rooted in lack of opportunities and resources. It's rooted in depression. So what we try to do is provide that alternative space where young people can thrive as well as still maintain their resiliency, but have a haven that they can come to.
So if the national conversation is about tolerance, it's about coming to grips with racial realities and mythologies of American, you know, politics and economics. In your case, your organization, Mural, is providing the doorways for people to experience opportunities, ways out, the idea that they don't have to accept their fate.
Exactly. They don't have to accept their fate. One thing that I always look at is that it's 50 years later after the Daniel P. Monahan study, The Negro Family. And in that, he brings a national case to the United States government about the government really looking at urban communities and finding solutions and ways to help bring better progress in those areas. So he looks at slavery, the Reconstruction, poverty, unemployment, wages, dimension growth, as we look at population growth. And a lot of those things that were brought out in that report, the remnants of that are in the communities that we live in and work in here in Chicago.
But why aren't those debates, why aren't those issues being championed at the national level and being championed in this presidential campaign by people at the national level on whatever party? Moynihan was a Republican back then, right?
Yes.
Why? What? How bad does it make you feel that you're not hearing that?
It makes me feel really bad because it's 2016. I think that it's not a priority, unfortunately, for the people that are running for office now. I think at that time we were looking at civil rights legislation. Dr. King was making a lot of headway with the work that he was doing across the country, even coming to Chicago as well 50 years ago to protest poverty in places around the city and lack of inclusion in some of the better communities. I don't think that people go back enough to look at where history has failed these communities. I think regarding police brutality and crime, we want to just look at the criminal, we want to look at the crime, but we don't want to look at the root causes. And I think one of the things that the political climate at that time did was force people to look at that and address that. Now, that's not, in my opinion, been successful, but it, at least it was recognized and acknowledged.
And to not acknowledge it for so long and to maintain still this focus on criminals, you get the situation just north of you in Milwaukee where an incident becomes a full-scale social protest that's producing violence on the street.
Exactly.
Just reiterate for us, how do we not just repeat a pattern of localized protests that then become cable TV shows and fail us in dealing with some of these structural issues that provide a way for people to say, I don't have to accept my fate?
I think we have to acknowledge that those issues are there. We have to acknowledge that a lot of these young people that are behind the trigger are depressed, they're stuck, they're marginalized, they're criminalized, they're underemployed, they're misunderstood, they're hungry, they're financially unstable, they're angry. And so when we look at a gun, for instance, in an urban community, that gun represents safety. That gun represents power. I don't have a salary. I don't have recognition outside of this gang or this block that I live. And so this lifestyle that I've encountered throughout generations of my family has now become a way of life.
But you're a community organizer on the streets, right? I mean, you're in these neighborhoods. You're not just, you know, testifying.
Yes, in
Congress.
The neighborhoods, as well as providing programmatic services indirectly. But yes, on the ground, attending funerals of young people who've been murdered.
So what do we do? If something happens to you, how do we carry on this resiliency, this legacy, this idea of being upbeat and having hope and not accepting our fate the day after something, God forbid, horrible would happen to you or one of your family?
I have tried in my work to be a pollinator and to plant seeds in every young person that we come across, that I come across, to continue the work. So I'm confident, just as Dr. King, when he walked in Market Park in 1966, that there would be someone else coming to help with that, or that the people around, like yourself and other folk that have the platform to encourage these dialogues that go beyond the surface level causes of what we see in these communities, we continue to push the conversation.
Aisha Jaco, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Aisha Jaco is the co-founder and director of the Youth Empowerment Organization in Chicago, Mural, M-U-R-A-L.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
More and more people are using more and more of the ocean, so the pressures have ramped up.
It's a living soup.
I realized I came across more plastic bags than fish.
We've really altered sound in the ocean.
Below that depth, in the dark.
The more science we do, the bigger and bigger this problem appears.
Why aren't we cleaning this up?
It secures our place in the universe, on the planet. It keeps us alive. Protecting nature is the best investment we can make.
Today we begin our series about the oceans, which I wanted to call Trashing Nemo, because quite literally that's what we are doing to the oceans. With some hesitation on the part of our staff, whose mood swings tend not to be as violent as mine, and the possibility of some Disney lawyers calling us up allowed me to accept Trashing the High Seas instead. Sea habitats are being destroyed at an alarming pace. Since the 60s, humans have removed over 20 million tons of wildlife from the world's oceans by means of dragging nets across the ocean floor. 90% of fish and sharks snatched from the ocean and placed on dinner plates faster than they can reproduce. Then there's climate change and pollution that have put our oceans in jeopardy, which in turn makes the viability of planet Earth a bit more dubious all around. Renowned oceanographer and National Geographic explorer-in-residence Sylvia Earle got knocked over by a wave on the Jersey Shore many decades ago as a little girl. And ever since, she has dedicated her life to making the oceans a productive sanctuary. Earle says we have the ability like never before to connect the dots to see what we're doing to the oceans. So why not save blue parks, make designated safe areas in the oceans now as a way of just getting started?
It doesn't take a serious trained scientist to look at the evidence. An open mind, just asking questions. Open minds, looking, observing, and reporting honestly what they see. It's what has propelled civilization through all time, but we are the beneficiaries of all that preceding knowledge. And we have a chance. We still have 10% of the sharks. They're not all gone. We still have a few oysters in Chesapeake Bay and New York Harbor. More turtles, more sea turtles, even though they are consumed in some places. And their eggs, well, protecting the nests is part of the solution to seeing that they get to grow up. But as attitudes change, there's the hope that we will understand that protecting nature is the best investment we can make because it secures our place in the universe on a planet that keeps us alive. Knowing that is the key to taking action.
What technology has been brought to bear on extracting fish from the ocean for use as human food and sometimes, you know, very high-end human restaurant food? And what is the cost of using that technology?
Our ability to strip the ocean, clear-cut the ocean in the last half century has been based on the technologies that did not exist prior to that time. Part of it in terms of knowing where in the ocean you are. Also relating to the technologies developed to find and locate submarines during times of war have been used to find, locate, and capture fish in an unprecedented level. New materials to make these enormous nets, whether they're drift nets or bottom trawlers, they're made of materials that are inexpensive relative to what was used ages ago. And long lines, literally long lines that are hundreds. Well, when you think of how many are deployed around the world, we're talking thousands of miles of lines with baited hooks every few feet. And, I mean, fish really don't have a place to hide anymore.
I mean, we were under the assumption for quite a long time that there was a certain pace of extraction from the ocean. And then all of a sudden, this spring, new estimates came out from a variety of scientific sources that were analyzing data. And it turns out that humans have removed 20 million tons of wildlife from the world's oceans, and actually possibly even far, far more than that. And so many of
that
the—
That were not accounted for.
That were not accounted for. And so many of the targets and, you know, frequency limits, fishing limits for species are based on these erroneous numbers. What's going to happen now that we understand far more fish were taken and, you know, it's going to be difficult to modify in midstream without just shutting down certain species altogether?
One of the revolutions that's underway concurrently is understanding that fish as wildlife, fish as individual creatures, like individual birds, like individual mammals, they are taking on a new level of respect as we understand that they behave differently. They have personality. They have faces. Everyone can be identified with its own distinctive DNA. And there are other ways of measuring the value of fish to humans. We have disrupted these tightly wound systems that put us at risk as we see a planet where the carbon cycle, the oxygen cycle, the water cycle, all of these basic systems that separate and characterize Earth as our life support system, a planet that works for us, but it has taken all preceding history to get it to a point where in a few decades we have unraveled these systems. And in the last 50 years, things have taken a sharp nosedive, despite our best efforts to manage.
You see hope in the blue parks. You see hope in the sense that there's a consciousness that was never there before, but is there now. How does it go beyond just watching your films and the films of other great nature photographers?
Well, the best hope is in communicating and just providing the evidence. I am trying to save the species I value the most, and that would be humankind. The idea that it's the century ahead that we need to look at, the next 1,000 years, the next 10,000 years, the decisions that we make right now, the next 10 years, will really determine the future for the next 10,000 years. So it's a big job. Let's get at it.
Sylvia Earle, oceanographer, National Geographic, explorer in residence, founder of Mission Blue, and global treasure, I would say. Sylvia, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, John. Let's go diving.
Indeed. Once upon a time, the guitar was popular music. Re-listening to Prince play that rock and roll Beatles classic at a Hall of Fame concert with Tom Petty and Stevie Winwood after his shocking death was a reminder of just how the guitar is not really so much a part of pop music today. For instance, in electronic dance music, or EDM, there's a $7 billion industry that comes together with samples, a drum machine, vocals, no guitar to be found anywhere. But something's changing, says John Schaefer, host of WNYC's Soundcheck and New Sounds. There's a comeback afoot, and 2016, he says, just might be the year of the guitar.
In recent years, pop music has definitely taken a turn towards the produced,
right?
You know, the keyboard-based.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a guitar solo, it's kind of notable. You know, when Katy Perry put guitar on Roar, it was
That's right, sort of
a big deal. So it seems like the guitar has kind of disappeared from pop music. But in fact, what's been happening is that you have these big lumbering dinosaurs that, you know, stride the world stage and everybody hears and sees them. And then there are all these like little furry creatures, you know, inhabiting the borders, the edges of the landscape. And that is where the guitar has never disappeared.
Let's talk about Y-Oak, who certainly benefits from producers running the show, but we've got an example of where the guitar emerges here.
Y-Oak kind of made its name with a song called Civilian. It was used for the trailer for The Walking Dead.
Mm.
The guitarist, Jen Wassner, who is also the singer, is an amazing guitar player. Listen to her in action.
More
is what we were saying when the album Civilian came out, John. But what they gave us instead was a turn towards keyboard-based music, much more pop-oriented, might have even had a little bit of an echo of 1980s new wave or even 70s disco. And there was some scratching of heads and gnashing of teeth among guitar fans. But recently, this year in fact, Y-Oak has gone back to the guitar. Jen Wassner has strapped on the old six string and is in great form on this new album called Tween.
You know, I love these arrangements where the percussion is in the foreground and you've got the guitar as the big sort of background.
Well, and with electric guitar, this really has become a way of using the instrument as an atmospheric effect. I mean, all those kind of jangly layers of guitar here, really rich, evocative soundscape for her voice and for the drummer. And that song is called If You Should See. And again, that's the band Y-Oak.
Great stuff.
One of the things that has happened in the world of acoustic guitar is a kind of renaissance of interest in what was known as American primitive. Now, you know John Fahey. You were
sure.
A fan of John
yeah,
Fahey,
yeah.
The late great American guitarist who started this so-called style. American primitive is a misnomer if there ever was one, because John Fahey drew on Hungarian music, Indian music, Indonesian music, and it was very sophisticated. There was nothing primitive about it. When he passed away, there was a kind of a sense of, well, who's going to keep this kind of finger-picking style alive? It emerges that Glenn Jones is probably that guy. He does a lot of work with alternate tunings. Nobody else can play. So that's Glenn Jones in a piece called Mother's Day. Now, that's on his 2016
right.
record called Fleeting, but what you're hearing is Glenn playing live here, downstairs in the green space in our ground floor
nice.
Performance venue.
You don't hear that much anymore, that kind of unaccompanied, just full-throated
yeah.
guitar there.
That kind of instrumental guitar style, it's not completely unheard these days. In fact, maybe we can talk a little bit about William Tyler. He takes that sound and amplifies it and adds a band to it. So he put out this album called Modern Country, which some people have taken to mean country music. I take it to mean just kind of a vision of modern America, both good and bad. And the title of this piece is I'm Gonna Live Forever If It Kills Me. That's William Tyler from his album called Modern Country, however you want to take that
right.
title.
So we got some women who have some serious electric creds here.
That, and you know, John, I think that is one of the things that has really sparked, if there is a renaissance of the guitar in recent years, it's been the idea that it is no longer this kind of male-dominated thing. We heard Jen Wassner of Y-Oak
yeah.
a few minutes ago. And then there's someone like Trixie Whitley. She is the daughter of singer-songwriter Chris Whitley.
Yeah.
yeah. And a fine guitarist in her own right. And she put out a record this year called Porta Bohemica. And as you listen to this, I mean, keyboards are great, but it's if your lyrics are really acerbic, really acidic, you want an electric guitar.
A blind to the masterpiece of
Brand new self-spoken words sound like machines in my
anti-gospel.
It's got a kind of, the guitar adds a kind of a stinging quality that I like a lot in this song by Trixie Whitley.
Surprise me, another one.
Well, how about Marissa Nadler? Yet another, you know, woman who knows her way around the six strings. And on her album, she actually has a bunch of dudes playing guitars. But the arrangements, you know, the sounds that are in her head are very electric, very atmospheric, and sometimes very loud. So there's a touch of 90s shoegaze, you know, that combination of kind of softly sung, whispery vocals and this wall of distorted electric guitar. That sound has come back a little bit in indie rock circles, and you hear it in that Marissa Nadler song.
Got one more?
Actually, yes. Luther Dickinson. His latest record, called Blues and Ballads, is a kind of return to his acoustic guitar roots.
Over the river, on Horseshoe Lake.
There is no way you could possibly pin that song down to a decade. I mean, that song could as easily be 100 years old as 100 hours old. That's Luther Dickinson with Horseshoe.
You been playing your guitar more?
I have not been playing it as much as I would like. How about you?
Two old men talking about guitars. Yes, the signature of the takeaway. Oh, that's great stuff, John. Thanks so much.
Glad to bring you some new sounds from this old instrument.
Yes, indeed. John Schaefer, host of WNYC's Soundcheck and New Sounds.
The night is so long, someday is so long.
And here's something to take with you today while we think about the rivers. The words of Sylvia Earle we heard a few moments ago are in the details of all the headlines today. The impact of serious ocean pollution at the Rio Olympics that competitors have simply had to endure. The 20,000 people in lowland Louisiana rescued from unprecedented flooding that has resulted in at least 5 deaths. The river systems continue to rise. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. We're paying attention. This is The Takeaway.
We were singing and dancing and crying in the rain, lay side by side in Gravel Springs.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.